Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cracking open a massive conflict that public employees face every single day.
Oh, yeah.
It's this legal nightmare where your job security demands you speak, but your constitutional rights, well, they demand silence. We are talking about the legal tripwire that can absolutely destroy high-profile police misconduct cases before they even get to a jury.
It's that high-stakes moment, you know. Where employment authority just crashes headlong into the Fifth Amendment.
The right against self-incrimination.
Exactly. And our mission in this deep dive is to unpack the constitutional boundary that was drawn almost 60 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to trace the doctrine from the landmark 1966 Garrity decision.
Right.
All the way to the absolute burden of proof that was established in Castigar. And more importantly, we're going to use New York's application in People v. Ferrick to show why these systemic institutional failures get labeled constitutional contamination.
And here's the critical framing for you, the listener.
Yeah.
This is not a discussion about creating some sort of anti-accountability measure.
Not at all.
This is about constitutional architecture.
Mm.
And it's so crucial because in organizations like law enforcement, the exact same conduct, I mean, think excessive force, tampering with evidence, lying to a supervisor, that can simultaneously be a violation of internal policy and a serious felony.
Mm.
The administrative interview, it's so often just a dangerous legal fiction.
It is. The Constitution demands that the government can't use its power as your employer to gain an advantage in a criminal prosecution.
It's acting in two different capacities.
Precisely. As the employer with the power to fire you, and as the sovereign with the power to imprison you, the state cannot use one of those powers to undermine the other.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We have to start at the foundation, right?
Right.
The core constitutional problem that Garrity v. New Jersey addressed back in 1966.
That's the one.
The Supreme Court basically said the government cannot force a public employee into that classic choice.
Yeah.
Self-incrimination or job loss.
And Garrity came out of a concrete, real-world example. You had New Jersey police officers who were under investigation for alleged ticket fixing. And the investigators, they warned them very clearly. If you refuse to answer questions about your official duties, you will be removed from office.
So they answered.
Of course they did. Who wants to lose their livelihood? And those compelled, coerced statements were then used by the state prosecutor to get criminal convictions against them.
And the court looked at that and said no.
The court looked at that arrangement and said that is textbook coercion. It is unconstitutional.
And the principle that came out of that is just foundational. Statements obtained under the threat of termination implied are constitutionally coerced.
They are compelled testimony. And because of that, they're inadmissible against the employee in any later criminal proceedings.
But we need to be really precise here about what Garrity does and doesn't do.
Yes, this is so important. It does not mean the officer is suddenly immune from prosecution for the underlying misconduct.
Okay.
Nor does it prevent the department from, you know, imposing administrative discipline or even termination if the conduct warrants it. It's very narrowly tailored.
So it just regulates the conditions of the questioning.
Exactly. It ensures the employee isn't forced to surrender their Fifth Amendment shield just to keep their paycheck.
And the Supreme Court, they had to clarify this almost immediately, right? Two cases, 2 years later in 1968. First up was Gardner v. Broderick.
Right. And Gardner said the state can't fire an employee just for refusing to waive their Fifth Amendment privilege.
So invoking your right to silence on its own can't be punished.
Cannot be punished. You cannot be terminated just for asking for your constitutional rights.
Okay. So then they closed the loop.
They did, with Uniformed Sanitation Men v. Commissioner. This decision confirmed that, yes, employees may be dismissed for refusing to answer questions that are narrowly tailored to their official duties.
There's a but.
There is a huge but. Only after immunity from criminal use of those statements is formally assured.
So if we synthesize all of that, you get this workable framework. The government has to make a choice, and they have to make it up front.
That's it.
If the department wants immediate answers to, say, impose administrative discipline, it has to accept the constitutional consequence.
Which is providing Garrity protection.
But if the government wants to preserve the option for a criminal case, then it has to respect the employee's right to silence and can't threaten them with their job.
Precisely. The Constitution forbids the state from trying to maximize both its administrative advantage and its criminal prosecutorial advantage at the same time. That choice has to be made before the first substantive question is even asked.
Which brings us to the price of choosing compulsion. Castigar v. United States in 1972. Before Castigar, there was this huge debate.
A huge debate.
Did the government need to grant what's called transactional immunity? I mean, absolute immunity from prosecution for the act itself. The Supreme Court said no.
Right. They said that's not required. But they ruled that use and derivative use immunity is constitutionally sufficient.
And this is where the legal action really is.
This is the critical distinction. Use is easy to understand. The statement itself cannot be read in court. Derivative use. That is the heavy hammer.
Okay, break that down for us.
Think of it this way. If an officer is compelled to testify and says, I buried the cash in the trunk of my partner's car and my partner helped me, well, you can't use that statement.
That's use.
Right. And you also can't use the cash you found in the trunk. That's the derivative use. Unless.
Unless what?
Unless you can prove, without a shadow of a doubt, that you knew about that cash and its location from a completely different independent witness before the officer ever opened their mouth.
Wow. So it covers physical evidence, investigative leads, witness IDs, even charging theories. Any path of inquiry that was shaped by what they were forced to say.
The core truth here is that information, once it's released, it acts like a poison. It contaminates the entire investigation.
It really does.
And that gets us to the most consequential holding in Castigar, the burden shift.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Because Castigar didn't just define the type of immunity.
Yeah.
It defined the consequence for the prosecution.
Yes.
Once a defendant shows their testimony was compelled, the affirmative burden shifts entirely to the prosecution. This is huge.
It's an enormous non-negotiable burden. They have to prove, using detailed auditable records, that every single piece of evidence they want to use in a criminal trial comes from sources wholly independent of those compelled statements.
They can't just say they acted in good faith.
Good faith is not enough. They have to provide the receipts.
I can already hear the critics, you know, arguing this is judicial overreach, that this burden shift makes it impossible to prosecute officers, even when they commit serious crimes. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to that claim that Castigar is just a get-out-of-jail-free card?
It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card for the crime. It's a procedural check on governmental coercion. If the prosecution loses that criminal case, it's not because the law is too protective.
It's because the government failed.
It's because the government failed its constitutional duty to separate its employer function from its prosecuting function. If the state chooses to compel testimony, it is also choosing to accept the responsibility of proving its evidence is clean.
That sounds practically impossible in a big, complex law enforcement investigation where you have different units, different people.
Mm-hmm.
They might communicate. Even informally, you know, across those administrative and criminal lines.
It leads to what are called Castigar hearings.
Which are what, exactly? Like a judicial audit.
That's a great way to put it. It's a full audit of the entire investigative file. And speculation, you know, vague assurances from investigators that they didn't rely on it.
That's not going to cut it.
Absolutely insufficient. The burden is evidentiary and it is rigorous. In practice, if a department has been sloppy about information segregation, they frequently fail the Castigar burden.
And then what happens?
That leads directly to the suppression of evidence, or often the dismissal of the criminal case entirely. The poison is in the well and you cannot filter it out.
So we have the federal rules defined, but how does this deadly serious contamination play out, you know, at the street level? Let's look at what the New York courts confirmed in People v. Ferrick.
Right.
What did Ferrick mean specifically for law enforcement agencies in New York?
So Ferrick, which was decided by the New York Court of Appeals, it just eliminated any lingering ambiguity that institutions were trying to exploit.
How so?
It ruled that when an officer is compelled to answer questions under threat of discipline, which is usually just implicit in the whole internal process, immunity attaches automatically by operation of law.
Automatically.
Automatically. It doesn't depend on some formal incantation by an internal affairs investigator, and it certainly doesn't require a prosecutor to formally bless it.
So institutions can't use these technical loopholes to say, well, we didn't formally grant immunity, so the statement is still usable.
No. Ferrick says the moment the coercion starts, the immunity starts, too.
Exactly. The risk just shifts entirely to the government the second they leverage their employment power to force a statement.
It does. Yeah. And what Ferrick really exposed were these massive institutional failures. Agencies proceed so quickly to just get statements, you know, to satisfy some administrative deadline or disciplinary timeline.
Without thinking about the consequences.
Without pausing to account for the constitutional consequences they're unleashing. And this results in criminal cases that are contaminated, poisoned, and that just cannot survive that rigorous Castigar scrutiny.
That procedural drift you mentioned. That's the danger zone, especially in these huge hierarchical organizations like the NYPD. Constitutional safeguards can easily become just, you know, procedural checklists, not mandatory structures.
Right.
Let's detail how this line gets blurred in reality. First, the fiction of voluntary questioning.
This is a classic breach point. An officer is summoned to internal affairs. They're sitting across from a supervisor or a high-ranking investigator. The setting is formal. It's intimidating.
Yeah.
And then they're told, maybe with a wink, this is voluntary.
But that label is meaningless, constitutionally speaking.
Absolutely meaningless. In a paramilitary organization, an officer reasonably understands that refusing to cooperate or, you know, walking out of that room is going to be treated as non-cooperation or insubordination.
And the consequence for that is discipline.
Discipline, up to and including termination, is the expected consequence of silence. So that implicit threat of job loss makes the questioning compelled, no matter what reassuring verbal label the supervisor uses. The coercion doesn't have to be overt to be unconstitutional.
Then you have this critical issue of ambiguous or delayed Garrity advisements. Officers get questioned extensively in these, quote, preliminary inquiries.
Mm.
They're gathering critical facts about the scene or the evidence, and only after potentially incriminating details have been pulled out is a formal advisement given.
And that sequencing is constitutionally fatal. Garrity protections attach the precise moment the compulsion occurs.
The very beginning.
The very beginning. So if the officer provides incriminating information in an early compelled inquiry, even if the investigator claims they were just trying to get basic facts, that information has already contaminated the system.
A delayed warning doesn't fix it.
It can. It's like trying to remove a stain with a warning label after the spill has already happened.
And speaking of internal policies, the system creates a genuine constitutional trap with rules like NYPD Administrative Guide Section 30410. This is the one that exposes officers to severe discipline, even termination, for providing false, misleading, or just inaccurate statements.
That policy, combined with ambiguous Garrity advisements, it forces an employee into a devastating triple bind.
Okay, what are the three paths?
First, silence risks discipline or termination for insubordination.
Yeah.
Second, compelled speech with, you know, imperfect recall risks charges of lying or inaccuracy, which is itself a firing offense.
Now the third.
Third, compelled speech risks contaminating the entire criminal investigation. The state is literally using its employment power to manufacture that constitutional dilemma. I mean, think about the human psychology there. The natural inclination in that pressured environment is to cooperate.
And that's how the trap springs shut.
Precisely.
But the most legally explosive breach point, the one that absolutely sinks cases in a Costigar hearing, has to be the simple act of sharing compelled testimony with criminal investigators.
It is the moment the poison moves from the administrative unit to the prosecution team. The danger includes summarizing the compelled account in some internal memo that gets circulated.
Or briefing liaisons from the DA's office.
Yes. Briefing liaisons on what the officer admitted, or flagging specific witnesses or evidence based on the compelled answers. That immediately creates derivative use. It contaminates the criminal case. And it makes the prosecution's Costigar burden impossible to meet years down the road in court.
And it's not about bad intent.
No, it's not about malicious intent. It's about an irresponsible flow of information.
So if the prosecution gets challenged in a Costigar hearing, they basically have to provide a receipt for every piece of evidence, showing a completely independent purchase. They can't just say, trust us, we ignored the officer's statement.
That's the perfect analogy. They have to demonstrate a firewall that was established from day one. If the criminal investigator learned about witness X from a compelled administrative summary, that witness is likely tainted.
And if they decided on a charging theory after reading the officer's coerced defense.
That theory is tainted. The burden is enormous because the risk of contamination is just so real.
So what does a system that treats the Constitution as a constraint, not an obstacle? What does that actually look like? What's the blueprint for lawful compulsion?
It requires structural discipline up front. And it's built around four key elements that come directly from the case law. First, there has to be a clear written advisement before substantive questions.
No ambiguity.
No ambiguity. It's binary. Is the interview voluntary, meaning zero consequence for refusal? Or is it compelled, meaning immunity is explicitly granted?
Okay, what's second?
An explicit grant of use and derivative use immunity. Simply saying this is administrative is not enough. The government has to explicitly state that this testimony and anything derived from it is traded away from the criminal realm forever.
Third, to prevent that contamination we talked about. Strict separation.
But hold on, strict separation with distinct personnel. In a busy precinct investigation, isn't that practically impossible? Are we asking institutions to become too rigid?
We are asking them to respect the Constitution. The requirements are distinct personnel, controlled files, and written protocols that prohibit cross-briefing. This has to be a real wall, not a rhetorical one.
Personnel can't overlap.
They can't, because human nature means information will be shared.
And finally, the receipts you mentioned earlier. Contemporaneous documentation. Traceable, auditable records of all criminal leads that go back to a source wholly independent of the compelled statements. If the government waits until litigation to try and piece together proof of independence, it almost always fails. The provenance of every piece of criminal evidence has to be audible from the moment the investigation begins.
So the systemic impact here, the goal is future-proofing. If the system isn't rigorously built to prevent contamination from day one, then contamination just becomes inevitable.
And the Fifth Amendment breach becomes predictable and repeatable.
Right.
You know, the constitutional limits that were established in Garrity and Costigar, they are not about granting officers some kind of special privilege. They are about maintaining systemic legitimacy.
I say more about that.
When departments choose shortcuts over constitutional rigor, when they prioritize getting quick answers in an administrative setting over building a legally sound case, they sabotage their own future prosecutions, they erode public trust, and they essentially delegate the job of constitutional boundary policing to judges.
Who then have to throw the case out.
Who have no choice but to throw the case out.
And here's a thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Compulsion without immunity is not accountability. It is unconstitutional leverage. The Constitution compels institutions to choose because it absolutely forbids them from using their employment power to extract a criminal advantage, which matters more to institutional stability and public trust. Getting statements fast or building cases that are legally sound and can survive rigorous scrutiny,